Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a board member for Pardes. Happy Hanukkah. I hope you're having a great time this holiday season. Please check back later this week. We're hoping to bring you a second podcast about Hanukkah. This week, Rabbi Schweiger discusses Parshat Miketz. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as a Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week is Parshat Miketz. I would like to follow up on a theme which I developed last year in the podcast on Parshat Vayeshev, which had to do with the development of Yosef's personality, so that we will be examining the beginning of our Parsha, chapter 41. But before we do that, I would like to look at the end of last week's parsha as background. In chapter 40, we're told how Yosef is in jail together with the butler and the baker. In fact, Yosef has been put in charge of all of the prisoners. And the butler and the baker reveal to him their dreams, which he solves. And when he solves the dream of the butler very favorably, and says that in another 3 days, you will be Pharaoh's birthday, and you will be reinstated in your position, Yosef then goes beyond his mandate and presents a request to the butler. If you look at chapter 40, verse 14. He says, if you would only remember me with you, when good is done to you, act towards me with kindness. Remember me to Pharaoh. Take me out of this place, because I was stolen from the land of the Hebrews. And here I also did not do anything. That I have been placed in this pit. And at the end of last week's parsha, after the butler has been reinstated into his position, we are told in chapter 40, verse 23, and the butler did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. And it's very striking, the emphasis. And one could say that it is not just that he forgot, but he consciously wants to forget Joseph. Once the butler has been reinstated, why bother remembering Joseph? Why bother bringing up the issue with Pharaoh? Theoretically, that could jeopardize his position to start asking for favors. The butler wants to go on with his life. The idea of chesed is totally lacking in his consciousness. But there is a very interesting midrash which Rashi quotes, which sees the lack of remembrance as being ultimately part of some divine plan. According to the midrash, God is actually punishing Joseph, punishing him because Joseph should not have made this request of the butler. Joseph should have had faith in God, that God would find a way to take him out. And as a result, God sees to it, or perhaps allows, that the butler should forget Joseph, so that Joseph should remain in jail as a punishment for his lack of faith. This midrashic comment is disturbing on a number of levels, but I want to choose one, and that is, there is a general principle in Judaism, Ein somchim al hanes. One does not rely on a miracle. To put it in the trite phrase, God helps those that help themselves. So here is Joseph, who is trying to take initiative, to do whatever he can to encourage the butler to help him out. Where is his lack of faith? What is wrong in having Joseph ask the butler to put in a good word with Pharaoh and then supplement that with prayers to God that God should reinforce his efforts so that in the end he will be taken out of jail? I would like to suggest that the problem is not in the request, but the problem is in the how. How does he request it? If we go back and look at verses 14 and 15, my sense is that Joseph comes across in a very negative light, as someone who's groveling, as someone who's begging, as someone who presents himself as being this unfortunate individual who has been framed. He has cast himself in this role of being this, we would say in Yiddish, a nebuch. And maybe there is a difference between asking and begging. And that is where Joseph went wrong. And I would like to now continue with the beginning of our parsha and see the change in Joseph. Our parsha begins by saying, and it was at the end of 2 years that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he was standing by the Nile. And in fact, as we go on to read, Pharaoh actually has two dreams. In one dream, he sees seven healthy cows who come up from the Nile, who are grazing, and then all of a sudden there are seven ill-looking cows who stand next to the healthy ones, eat them up, and he wakes up. And then he has a second dream. There are seven sheaves that are coming up, very beautiful. And another seven sheaves are coming up that have been blasted by the wind. And the bad sheaves swallow up the good ones. And then Pharaoh wakes up once again, and behold, there is a dream. I would like to point out now that although Pharaoh has two dreams, it seems that Pharaoh, when he wakes up, feels that the two dreams are two sides of the same coin, so that at the end of the night, he feels he has had a dream. I would just like to reiterate something I said in last year's podcast. It is very interesting that dreams play a central role in the life of Yosef. Initially, Yosef has two dreams. At the end of last week's parsha, the baker and the butler each have a dream. Once again, two dreams. And this time, Pharaoh has two dreams. And in each case, it would seem to be that the two dreams are a unit. As I said a moment ago, two sides of the same coin that simply reinforce each other. And when we look at our chapter, Chapter 41, verse 8. In the morning, it seems Pharaoh wakes up and he's disturbed, and he sends for his magicians and wise men, and he tells them his dream, and once again, it says it in the singular. And it says, and they were not able to solve them to Pharaoh. And perhaps this is the key. There are solutions which are offered, but they're presented as being two separate dreams with different solutions. They're not presented as being an organic unit. Whereas Pharaoh senses this is one dream. And then all of a sudden, in verse 9, the butler speaks to Pharaoh. And he says to Pharaoh, I would like to now mention my error, my mistake. And he goes and relates the story of how Pharaoh had placed him into jail, and how he had had a dream, and how he had even dreamt the solution, not of his dream, but of the baker's dream. And then he brings up the person of Yosef. And note how he brings him up. And there was with us this is verse 12. There was with us this Hebrew lad, a slave, a servant, to the butcher. And we told him, and he solved our dreams, each one according to his solution. And then he says, and the solution that he gave is exactly what happened. Why is the butler mentioning this now? It would seem to be this is not done out of altruism, out of a sense of gratitude to Yosef, to pay him back for the wonderful benefit which he had given him by solving his dream, for the wonderful news he had given him. The simple way of understanding this is that the butler is an opportunist. All that matters to him is his position. Initially, he does not want to bring up anything about Joseph because that may jeopardize his position. But now, here is an opportunity to ingratiate himself further with Pharaoh. He will be the one who will now come up with a solution to Pharaoh's dreams. And even if Joseph will solve it, he will get all the credit. Why do I say this? The way that he presents Yosef, in verse 12, is very, very negative. Who is this Joseph? He is a lad, a Hebrew, a slave. He is not somebody who has any intrinsic value. He is not someone who in any way is fit to serve the king. But he is someone who can be properly used in the service of the king. So that the butler is hoping to fly on the coattails, so to speak, of Joseph. And then we're told in verse 14, and Pharaoh sends and calls for Joseph, and they rush him from the pit. And Joseph shaves, changes his clothing, and comes before Pharaoh. Note the contrast. When Pharaoh sends for Joseph, he is being rushed from the pit. He's rushed because the king wants him. He has to hurry. But it says Joseph shaved, changes his clothing. That is not what Pharaoh asked him to do. That is not what the people around him wanted him to do. That was his decision. And here is the beginning of a different image of Joseph. I said earlier, after Joseph solved the dream of the butler, he groveled before him. He begged him, put in a good word with Pharaoh, get me out of here. In a certain way, he was also an opportunist who was trying to latch on that opportunity, irregardless of the way he did it. Perhaps spending 2 years in jail has made him aware of how his dignity should be reflected. When he has this opportunity to finally come before Pharaoh, he will do it differently. It is important for him to shave, to change his clothing, to present himself before Pharaoh, not as this abject Hebrew lad slash slave, but to come before Pharaoh as a man of dignity. And then we read on how Pharaoh tells Joseph the dreams. But before he tells him the dreams, I would like to note the two verses, 15 and 16. The first thing which Pharaoh says to Joseph is, I had a dream, and there is no one to solve it. Note he does not say he had dreams in the plural, a dream. And then also note Joseph's response. Joseph says to Pharaoh, when Pharaoh had said to him, and I've heard that you are someone who solves dreams, in verse 16, Joseph responds by saying, it is not me. God will answer the peace of Pharaoh. Two things that are important. Number one, it is God, it is not me. A profound expression of humility, as we will see in a few moments. Number two, ultimately, the solution of the dream will bring peace to Pharaoh. If Pharaoh has been very disturbed by this dream, Joseph will now allay his fears, his concerns. Pharaoh goes on to describe the dream. Let us now skip to verse 25. And Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dream is one. That which God is about to do, he is telling Pharaoh. And then Joseph goes on to say that the dream has to do with 7 years. 7 years of famine, 7 years of plenty. First, there will be 7 years of plenty, but those 7 years of plenty will be forgotten, as it says in verse 30, because of the 7 years of famine that follow. And the 7 years that follow will be very, very heavy famine. Verse 31. So that Joseph emphasizes to Pharaoh, there is really only one dream here, a dream which is speaking about 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. The question is, then why is it repeated? And in verse 32, Joseph says, it's repeated because the matter is imminent. God is quick to do it. But let me backtrack for a moment. When Joseph initially says to Pharaoh in verse 25, your dream is one, he also says to Pharaoh, what is the point of your dream? It is a prophecy. God is now speaking to you in this dream and showing you what he is about to do. Why does the dream come twice? Because God is showing you that this is imminent. I mentioned earlier, dreams play a central role in the life of Joseph. Last year, I also mentioned in a podcast that dreams play a central role in the life of Jacob. In Parshat Vayetze, in the beginning of the parsha, Jacob has a dream with God standing on top of the ladder, angels going up and down, and then he has a dream at the end of the parsha. The difference between Jacob's dreams and Joseph's dreams is that in Jacob's dreams, God appears, God speaks. In Joseph's dream, and not only Joseph's dream, but all the dreams that he encounters, the butler and the baker, Pharaoh, God does not appear overtly. And yet what Joseph is now saying is, even though God does not appear overtly and God is not speaking, God is the source of dreams. God is actually speaking to you covertly. And not only that, but God speaks to you in the reality. And this is a major discovery of Joseph. When we think of the patriarchs, and then afterwards look at their children, a major difference is that God speaks to each of the patriarchs. But God never speaks to Joseph and his brothers. And yet, nevertheless, they have a relationship with God. On the one hand, that relationship is based on the tradition which has been handed down to them from their parents. But on the other hand, the relationship is based on seeing God in their reality, which on the one hand could mean in the events that happen, and on the other hand, in their dreams. And here is where Joseph is making a correlation. God is about to act in the reality. The fact that there's going to be plenty and there's going to be a famine is not just a fact of nature. It is an act of God. God is making that happen. Joseph does not explain to Pharaoh why. Why is God doing this? He is simply forecasting, this is what's going to happen. But not only is this going to happen, but God wants Pharaoh to know it's going to happen. And because of that, he is sending him these dreams. And then all of a sudden, when we look at verses 33 through 36, Joseph seems to offer gratuitous advice. He says to Pharaoh, "And now, let Pharaoh seek out a man who is understanding and wise, and put him in charge of Egypt. And let him now prepare Egypt during the years of plenty to gather food, so that in the end, Egypt will be sustained during the years of famine." Verse 36. When Yosef offers this solution, we can immediately read into this. Here is Joseph the opportunist. Here is a chance for him to finally get out of jail, to take on a leading role. He knows how to grab the moment, and he also does it in a very subtle way. Not like the comment that he made to the butler. He doesn't come and say to Pharaoh, "Please, take me out of jail. Put me in charge of all this food. I will save Egypt." He offers a suggestion, puts it out there. Let Pharaoh then make the decision whether he wants to take it up, so that the initiative can be seen as an honest, objective evaluation and not as a cheap opportunist shot. And the faith in God is that he has now done his job. He has done it in a dignified way. Let God now bring it to fruition. Let me also add, in a certain way, this suggestion is very reasonable in the context and would not be seen by Pharaoh as being the expression of an opportunist. If Joseph is in fact saying, God is trying to tell Pharaoh what's going to happen, it begs the question, towards what end? Why should God want Pharaoh to know what's going to happen? And a reasonable explanation is because God wants Pharaoh to be able to now take charge of his reality. God will bring plenty. God will bring a famine. By informing Pharaoh of what's happening, God is now giving him the opportunity to take a preemptive strike and to weather the famine that will come. So that Joseph's suggestion is a natural extension of his solution of the dream. It is not to be found in the dream, but it is a logical derivative of the fact that there is a dream. When we compare what Joseph does here with what happened in the story of the butler and the baker, there has been a change. I have highlighted the difference in terms of how Joseph presents himself. The dignity, the humility, the poise, as opposed to someone who is perhaps still an opportunist, a little bit too compulsive. Note also in terms of the relationship to dreams. With the butler and the baker in chapter 40, Joseph says, God knows the solution of dreams. Tell me. In our section, Joseph says, God not only knows the solution, God is the one who is the source of the dream. And the dream is basically a foreshadowing of what God will do in the reality. It presents a much more comprehensive view of God, of a God who acts in the world, of a God who brings dreams, prophecy. And I would also go back to what we mentioned earlier. At the very beginning, Joseph says, God will answer the peace of Pharaoh. Ultimately, of a God who is looking for the well-being of people. So that even if God brings a famine, God would like the people to survive the famine. And hence, God brings the dreams to give them the means to do so. When we go to verse 37, the matter was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants. And then Pharaoh says to his servants in verse 38, is there to be found anyone like this man in whom there is the Spirit of God? And once again in 39, Pharaoh says, after God has told you this, there is no one as understanding and wise as you. Note that Pharaoh immediately acknowledges Joseph. Not only does he see the validity of his words, but he's also impressed with him as a man in whom there is the Spirit of God. At this point, the transformation is complete. In last week's parsha, the parsha begins by telling us, these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph was 17 years old. He was a lad. And throughout the parsha, Joseph is described as a lad. There are moments when he is a man in the house of Potiphar. But he goes back and forth. But from this point on, he is no longer a lad. He is a man. A man of distinction. A man of dignity. Because he has matured. He has learned the lesson of what it is to become a leader who is not looking for power, looking for his own best interest, but a leader who is somebody who is able to grab the opportunity, but not be compulsive, not be groveling, but do it in the most dignified way for the benefit of all. Someone who can very much see beyond himself and make room for others. And then we're told in the continuation of this that Pharaoh says to Joseph in verses 40 through 45. And now I will put you on my house. You will be in charge of my people. It is only the throne that will place me above you. Behold, I have placed you on Egypt. And then we're told that Pharaoh gives him his ring. He puts special clothing, linen garments on him, a gold chain around his neck. He gives him a special chariot, changes his name, parades him all over Egypt. And in verse 44, with the full power vested in Pharaoh, he says to him, no man will lift up their hand and foot in all of Egypt without you. And the final thing, he is given a wife, Osnat. And then we see at the end of verse 45 and verse 46, how Joseph goes out to Egypt. 30 years old he is when he stands before Pharaoh and then goes out before the Egyptian people. Note the fact, clothing plays a very important role in Joseph's life. Initially, he's given a coat by his father that sets him apart from the brothers. It is not just a gift, but it is an expression of a role, of a leadership role in the family. But that coat is perhaps abused when Joseph somehow sticks it into the brothers to highlight how he will be a leader and has dreams that just increase their hatred towards him. And eventually it explodes when they sell him into slavery. Joseph also has nice clothing when he's in the house of Potiphar and assumes a leadership role in that context. But perhaps the good life also gets to him there. He's a little bit caught up with it. And maybe eggs on Mrs. Potiphar to the point where she strips him of his coat, which then leads to him being stripped of his role and thrown into jail, or as he himself says, into another pit. Twice he has garments of majesty, and twice he abuses them. And he is stripped of those garments, thrown into a pit. But the third time, he is given those garments, and he assumes that role for the rest of his life. He has learned the lesson of what it means to be in a position of leadership, where it is not self-aggrandizement, where it is not self-gratification, but where it is, from beginning to end, service for the people around him. On one level, being put in charge of the Egyptian people is a way that he can serve Egypt, that he can help them survive during a famine. On another level, it will be the means by which he will save his family and enable them to be provided with all their needs during that difficult period. When Joseph is placed as Pharaoh's second in command, he has assumed his role, his destiny. In another podcast, I mentioned that Jacob is the quintessential Galut Jew. But Joseph is ultimately the quintessential Galut Jew. We have noted previously the parallels between Jacob and Joseph. And both of them make their mark when they are in the Galut. The difference, though, is that Jacob builds a family. Jacob accumulates a personal fortune during the 20 years that he is in Laban's house. But during those 20 years, he is constantly fighting to survive, and he's always worried that at any moment it will all fall apart. And ultimately, he leaves that framework, comes back to the land of Israel. But Joseph is the one who spends the bulk of his life in the Galut, the one who succeeds beyond the wildest expectations, who makes it in every way, who comes back to the land of Israel only after he dies, when his bones are brought back, and that being only hundreds of years later. Joseph is the picture of the Jew who flourishes in the Galut, not just survives, who is able to perhaps change the reality around him. One might also say, who not only administers and provides, but also brings to that environment a consciousness of God, so that Pharaoh, in chapter 41, verse 39, says to Joseph, after God has told you all this, there is none like you. In verse 38, there is no one to be found, a man like you who has the Spirit of God. Joseph is able to bring the awareness of God to all those around him. I would just like to point out, there is a very interesting parallel between these last verses in chapter 41 and what we find in Megillat Esther in chapter 8. In Megillat Esther, we find that a related descendant of Joseph, not from the tribe of Joseph, actually from Benjamin, called Mordechai, eventually becomes the second, the right-hand man of King Ahasuerus. And in chapter 8, verse 2 in Megillat Esther, we're told how the king gives him the ring, similar to Pharaoh, who gives Joseph his ring. We're told in verse 15 how Mordechai goes before the king wearing garments of royalty. And we all know that earlier in the story, that Haman paraded Mordechai in the streets on the special horse of the king, in the same way that Joseph has the chariot of the king. Once more, we have a Jew who has succeeded in the Galut, who has been raised to a very high position, where being in that position can benefit the people around him and ultimately his fellow Jews. I do not want to get into the politics of Jews who are influential in the king's palace. But I would just like to go back to a point which I mentioned a moment ago. On a certain level, Joseph now has the opportunity to bring the awareness of God to the environment of Egypt. By speaking the God language, he gets Pharaoh to also acknowledge God. And perhaps this is a central idea in the story of Chanukah. The Battle of the Maccabees is not just a political battle to somehow regain Jewish sovereignty. The Battle of the Maccabees, first and foremost, is a religious battle. The goal was to purify the temple, rededicate it. The menorah, with its candles, is a symbol of Torah. There is a verse in Proverbs which says, Kiner mitzvah v'torah or. The mitzvah is like a lamp. The Torah, its light. The miracle of Chanukah, the message of Chanukah, is to somehow take the light of the Torah, spread it outside, to have the temple radiate beyond its borders. By Joseph being in the position that he is, it is a way of taking the altars which his ancestors had dug, the altars where they had called out on the name of God in the land of Israel, and to take that message outside the land of Israel, to be able to call out in the name of God, but in a different capacity. Through the events of the reality, to be able to make people aware of how God is very much acting. And not only acting, but of a God who ultimately is interested in the well-being of the people of the world. May we learn that message and never lose sight of the fact of what our mission is as the Jewish people, to bring that awareness of God to the world, and an awareness of a God, as Joseph said, who seeks out the peace of Pharaoh and all of humanity. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your email via podcasts@pardesusa.org. Please remember to check back later this week to see if we've been able to bring you a second episode this week about Hanukkah. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.